You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you all for coming. We are unfortunately down one of our panelists, Sasha Denovan-Chuk, because he's been doing so much traveling, but was not able to get an American visa on time. Another of our panelists, Maxim Butkiewicz, is on the way from Dulles, where unfortunately he appears to have gotten called into secondary inspection, delaying his arrival. But we hope to have him before the end of the program. It's obviously been a very historic 6 months in Ukraine. I was in Kiev in early December during the OSCE ministerial, and although obviously, there was quite a bit of excitement after the first big demonstration on the Maidan. I don't think anyone at that time foresaw things deteriorating to the point they are now. I had the opportunity to have dinner with our guests last night, and one of the interesting things that we discussed were the differences between what took place on the Maidan over the last few months and the Orange Revolution a decade ago, and I think they pointed out that one of the more interesting differences is that then people came out because of the calls to political leadership, whereas this time around most of the people who came out to the Maidan were individuals, civic activists, people who came out on their own, and I think that that new sort of breadth of willingness to engage on the part of ordinary Ukrainians had a lot of potential for positive developments in the country over the long term. Unfortunately, however, the Russian authorities decided that they could not afford to let Ukraine go, and the result is that we now have the annexation of Crimea and fairly ham-handed efforts by the Russians to stabilize the situation in eastern Ukraine. For those of you who haven't been on the news in the last few hours, including an assassination attempt on the mayor of Kharkiv, Ukraine's second city today, and a bunch of people in camouflage uniforms with baseball bats breaking up a peaceful pro-Ukrainian march in Donetsk today. So we were taking advantage of the fact that some of our partners from Ukraine were coming to the United States briefly, to give them a chance to speak today about their impressions on the ground on Maidan, Crimea, and eastern Ukraine, and in particular the human rights problems and implications of everything going on today. So our first speaker will be Oleksandr Matveychuk, who is chairman of the board of the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine. She's also a member of the Rada's Human Rights Advisory Council and the coordinator of the Euromaidan SOS movement. We will then have Volodymyr Shcherbachenko, who is from Luhansk in the east, where he is the chairman of the board of the East Ukrainian Center for Civic Initiatives and one of the organizers of peaceful civic protests in Luhansk. We've asked each of our speakers to start off with a presentation about the events, and then we'll get into their recommendations for what the rest of the world, and particularly the U.S. and the U.S. government, should be doing. And then we will open this up for questions and answers. Because it is being recorded, I would ask that if you have a question, please raise your hand. One of my colleagues will bring a microphone by. And for the purpose of the recording, to please speak into the microphone, state your name, your affiliation, and your question or comment. So with that, Sasha.
Thank you very much for having me here. I represent the civil initiative Euromaidan SOS, which was created on November 3rd last year, following the brutal dispersion of peaceful protesters on Independence Square. During the entire Euromaidan period, we worked 24 hours a day to provide legal help to people suffering from persecution. We helped hundreds of Euromaidan protesters in Kyiv and the regions who had been beaten, arrested, tortured, as well as their relatives of those killed or missing. we still continue our work in Crimea and eastern regions. Euromaidan SOS was assisted by hundreds of people from all over Ukraine. They helped find lawyers for people beaten and detained and to monitor court hearings. They kept a guard in hospitals, looked for people in police stations and morgues. The vast majority of these people had never been involved in formal human rights work. However, for all of us, human rights and freedoms were not simply a phrase, and our sense of human dignity made it impossible at such a critical time to stand alone. Euromaidan was essentially about the struggle for human rights, and for that reason, the largest demonstration during those months were clearly in defense of human rights. For example, on December 1st, people came out not only in support of European integration for Ukraine, but against the violence of Berkut police officers who had brutally beaten students. The protests on January 19 this year against the repressive anti-protest laws were in defense of fundamental rights and freedoms which had been trampled. There were numerous attempts throughout the entire Euromaidan protest to give the civil resistance a fascist face and to present the protesters as anti-Semites and xenophobes. This is particularly cynical given the fact that Maidan was officially supported by national communities and associations. Its participants took on the task of guarding Jewish religious buildings, and there were representatives of various national minorities in the protests, including the Jewish Self-Defense Unit. The total violence and lawlessness which we lived through during these recent months in Ukraine reflect general worrying trends in the post-Soviet space, where a real battle is taking place between forces in support and those against democracy. However, if for some Ukrainians choice is a question of geopolitics, for us it's a question of human rights. 133 people died during the Euromaidan period, and around 10 more possible cases are being checked. Euromaidan SOS is still looking for 93 people who disappeared at that time. The number of deaths is unfortunately also rising. On April 20, Anatoly Nechiporenko died after he had injury, which he got on February 7. Like many others, he leaves a family. It's only several weeks since the gunning down of protesters in the center of Kyiv. Therefore, in speaking about the threats to civil society in Ukraine, we need to realize that the situation remains unstable and differs markedly from one region to another. At present, however, Ukraine is facing military occupation of the Crimea and active interference by Russia in the east and south of the country. In view of the above, we can identify the following main dangers for the development of civil society in Ukraine. First is crushing of independent civil society in Crimea. Crimea is presently under the armed dictatorship installed by Russian Federation Armed Forces following an illegal so-called referendum held with rifles pointed at people. This is a widespread obstruction of journalists trying to carry out their work and attack on press and television staff. All Ukrainian television channels are removed from air. Peaceful protests against the occupation are brutally dispersed by armed vigilantes groups, which were partly formed from several thousand Cossacks brought in from Russia. Civil organizations report that activists are facing beating, harassment, damage to belongings, threats and intimidation in connection with their public activities. Several dozen activists have been abducted, and the whereabouts of some are still unknown. There is a real danger of inter-ethnic conflict between the aggressors and so-called self-defense vigilantes on the one hand and the Crimea Tatar on the other. There is a relentless flow of people forced to move from the Crimea to the other oblasts of Ukraine. The second dangerous trend is radicalization of civil society in eastern regions. Because there is active political interference by Russia in the east of Ukraine under the guise of artificially created civil organizations and movement. The activities of such initiatives are aimed to creating the idea that specific oblast wants to join Russia. Despite the fact that the electoral preference of this residents of this oblast indicates that such organizations are not supported by the majority of society, the demonstrative lack of response from the law enforcement bodies and aggression of and violence from these groups created an atmosphere of pressure and terror with respect to members of civil society. There have been cases where peaceful demonstrators are dispersed and participants beaten up, journalists harassed, their property damaged, activists took as hostages, tortured, and even killed. Some activists have been forced into hiding with their families sent to the other oblasts. The situation will also seriously hamper radical reform in the country and free movement in the declared direction of European integration. We have seen for the first time in the more than 70 years that a part of sovereign state has been seized by force and joined to Russia. The question now is not only what Ukraine should do, it's also what democratic states should do in the world where the taboo against annexation has been breached. Because there is a thing which has no state borders, and human rights are one of such things.
Hello everyone, my name is Volodymyr Shcherbachenko. I'm working for an NGO, East Ukrainian Center for Civic Initiatives, but here I am represent not this NGO, but civic sector of Luhansk Euromaidan. It's a gathering of civic activists, NGO representatives, which during recent months gathered together, protest peacefully, try to support unity of our country, our military forces, and establish dialogue with pro-Russian protesters, and also trying to control our new government on local level. So my role here is explaining you the situation in our region, and I would be happy to do so. So, in order to understand the situation, I explain the situation. I conditionally divide the population of our Luhansk and Donetsk region in three parts. So it's pro-Russian supporters, it's a majority of people who do not support Russian vectors of future of this territory, but who are really inactive and waiting for something good happen. And another part, one more part of population, it's supporters of pro-Ukrainian vector of future, it's supporters of European vector of Ukrainian of Ukrainian future. So it's pro-Russian protesters or supporters, it's about between 10% and 15% of population, those people who are like not active and want to stay in Ukraine, probably a little bit change Ukraine, not like now. It's about 70-80%, and those who support Euromaidan ideas, it's also about 10-15%. The difference between those groups and pro-Russian active groups, pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian or Ukrainian, that the Russian part, they're really aggressive. They believe that their time is come, and they are willing to use weapons in order to represent their ideas and implement their vision of Ukrainian future. So what happens in our part of the country now, it's with a strong support of Russia, of the military forces, this small part of a population, pro-Russian, trying to навязать. Enforce their vision of our future to the whole country and to the whole region. And what do they do for this? In several cities and towns of Luhansk and Donetsk region, the state building city halls were taken over, and they under the control of militarized forces. Local people with some military officers from Russia, and in my city, the state security service building is also taken over, and they control a block around this building. And the role of the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian government is weak, and is especially weak in our region because the political elite is tight and actually comes from the previously ruling party of region. They don't want to lose their power, and they use this Russian forces and Russian involvement to continue to rule and preserve the corrupt practices. And and actually they control local militia, not local militia, but militia. We don't have local militia, it's a part of kind of national internal forces, we call it. But those people who work in this militia, they do not actually represent a vision of central government. They actually in many cases support this as Russian separatists, and people who represent another vision of future of our region, they cannot be under the protection of any forces. Actually, they can be beaten. They were many times beaten. Several peoples who represent this Ukrainian vector of policy were killed, and we do not expect any positive changes. I wouldn't want to say that, but the situation is really difficult, and if it wouldn't be a strong internal involvement, I would say we may expect more people will be killed, and it will be the right of peaceful protest or just representation of you will be severely violated. The election, which should happen in a month, may be under the threat to be collapsed. In our region, which is really important, which we want election happened, we want new government, new president, we want stability in our country, and the majority of population doesn't want to join Russia, they want just kind of normal life, prosperity, and the role of Russian media is also very important. They brainwashed local people, and people, all this majority of population, they will not able to explain what they really want. They kind of do not have clear vision what kind of country do they want to have. They want probably more respect to Russian language, and at the same time there is no violation of Russian speaking population. They want more power at the local level, and they call it federalization, which is not always the same thing. Yes, and my strong belief that the situation became worse and worse, and we Ukrainians will be, we are able to find, to create a dialogue between all these three parts. But this dialogue prevented to be happen by strong Russian involvement. And unfortunately, our country and our government too weak to cope with this strong Russian involvement. And we need help from international community to protect our country, to protect people from being killed, from further human rights violation. And that is why we are here. We need support from the United States government, from the American people. And as Alexandra said, it's really important to help us to have a peaceful election, to cope with Russian government. And we will talk later about what we actually suggest and ask to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Glad to see that Maxim was able to make it here in spite of the best efforts of American customs. Would you care to say a few words to the group?
Yeah, thank you very much. I apologize for being delayed. I didn't expect to spend so many hours at the airport and trying again and again to explain what is the purpose of my visit. And, you know, to talk about Ukraine to a number of our partners, counterparts, those who are interested in the U.S., doesn't seem to be a good reason for Ukrainian national nowadays to arrive to the U.S. So, fortunately, at the end of the day, right now they have your phone number. They've written it down just to get in touch if anything. So, I was supposed to be here from the very beginning. I was not, and if I will repeat something which has been already said by my colleagues, I apologize in advance. Just to make a few initial comments in a way. First, me as well as my colleagues, we were part of Maidan. I don't know, Maidan movement. Maidan is a phenomenon starting from 30th of November in very different capacities. Of course, it makes our testimonies and our statements a bit more vulnerable because we are biased. The cool thing about it is that we have very good reasons to be biased. We've been there, we've seen that, it's not, we do not take our information from the press only and from something which was told to us by someone. To me and my colleagues and to many other people whom I know, not all of them, but most of them, the vast majority, of course, it was a civic movement, not divided by regions at the time, and it is, I don't believe it, it is really divided now, which had at its very core the demand for respect for civil liberties and for human rights. I mean, it sounds quite, you know, these big words, but this is what it was. And it could be seen also in the way more and more general public being mobilized to take part in the protest, with every next governmental step violating more rights of protesters than of NGOs, than of civil groups, than of different various groups of population. With all these steps, more people were involved because they realized that their rights are under attack. At Maidan itself, there was no division when it came to language, which is supposed to be a big issue in Ukraine, but it was not, at least at Maidan. I've heard Russian being spoken as often, or maybe even more often sometimes than Ukrainian. No difference when it came to ethnic allegiance or religious beliefs. The core was about right to protest, was about corruption, was about, in the first place, accountability and responsibility of those who are in power. You will recall what the whole thing started with. It started with the Ukraine-EU association agreement, but first big wave and different wave of protesters coming to the streets. They went there after the violent dispersal of the protesters in early hours of the 30th of November. And those who went next morning to the streets, they went there because they realized that police officers and those who gave orders will again be unaccountable, will enjoy impunity for severe, cruel, and absolutely having no reason, like beating of peaceful protesters. And of course, the explanation which was provided by that time authorities to protesters, it has shown the treatment, the attitude of those in power towards the protesters. The authorities explained that they had to disperse the peaceful protest in such a violent manner because they wanted to install a Christmas tree in the center of Ukrainian capital. And this is why they had to clean the square. It's like one, this drop, which in a way reflects the ocean. It reflected the whole attitude of the previous regime towards the citizens, and this is what sparked initial protest, and then every next action involved more and more people. So to us, it is about, of course, human rights and civic liberties. When what happened later, what happened next, of course, involves many factors. I mean, next after the fall of the regime, I could not agree more with Vladimir regarding Russian media influence. It was huge, and it's still huge in entire regions. Information about what goes on in Kiev was received rather via Russian media channels than by Ukrainian ones. And first, to people in Kiev, it was laughable, but then it became sinister. And then it just it fed this feeling of injustice and warmongering. But of course, at the time, everyone hoped that this is just the usual informational war. It will not develop into actual military aggression. And at some point, this is exactly what happened. One of the structural problems of the events is that literally between the fall of the regime and the beginning of military intervention of Russia in Crimea, we've had 5 days, or maybe 4 days of time when civic activists, together with those actors who were interested, started to not only make plans, but also trying to implement the first steps to make their country anew on very different foundations. It was all, I can just recall experience of my organization I work at. It's a small NGO based in Kiev, and we usually deal with issues of discrimination, non-discrimination, and assistance to refugees and asylum seekers, among other things. So straight away we started to produce a roadmap how to finally make proper asylum system in Ukraine, because what we've had before was rather a joke, and refugees were quite often under threat, politically motivated, if they came from Russia, for instance, all from Central post-Soviet Central Asia. And the same happened in all other sectors of civil society. Those who worked with police brutality and police impunity started to produce roadmap what to do with police forces, how they should be reformed, totally reformed, of course, on totally different grounds. The same was about all other sectors of the state management. And then it all changed in one day, in a few days basically, because of course when you have military intervention in your country, you do not, well, it's really difficult to make structural changes in a situation, in a warlike situation. And second, it is very difficult to, or much more difficult to criticize the new leadership when you are at warlike situation. You know, when we are at war, the leadership should do what it should what should be done. And this, of course, extremely limited the room for maneuver, which we've had. And also this old card played many times before, mostly by pro-Moscow Ukrainian politicians, language division and regional division. It never went so well. It all looked like a myth to everyone, both in the west and east and south and north. Of course, Russian-speaking population would prefer to have an opportunity to use Russian in different sectors of everyday life and in institutionally. But this is an opportunity which was there all of this time, including Crimea in the first place. In Crimea, 90% of, for instance, school kids, they studied in Russian, 7% in Ukrainian and 3% in Crimean Tatar. So it's really difficult to say anything about persecution of Russian language in Crimea, where there was effectively no other language but Russian in use. But all methodology, methodologically implemented by Russian propaganda machine regarding these mysterious fascists occupying Kiev and trying to persecute Russian-speaking population. It might sound surprising, but with the assistance of the well-oiled propaganda machine of Russian media, it influenced many people in the south, in Crimea in the first place, and to much lesser extent people in some eastern regions. Just to wrap up this initial part of mine, I just would like to make maybe two, 3 points, more practical ones. First one is that the whole developments afterwards, they did not influence the agenda of civil society organizations and their partners. Up to now, in my very subjective view, most important things which are done in Ukraine when it comes to democratic reforms or when it comes to very practical issues, humanitarian needs of everyday life right now, they are done by civil society organizations due to the weakness of the government, but also due to the extreme unseen before level of mass mobilization of society, when people for a few months were just basically given what they could in order to assist others, assist in very different ways, taking them out of the fire line, treat their wounds, or maybe assist in resettlement of those who had to leave occupied territories. Of course, there is a certain level of tiredness among those who for almost half a year now dedicate everything they have to attempts to make things better, but everyone whom I know, they are as dedicated as before to continue the same way and to remake our country anew. This is a massive task given modern history of Ukraine. We all understand that, but basically it looks like now there is no other way. And no one can even think about all these sacrifices made in all these months in vain. It is not possible. And for those people who were in the streets, it is not possible. So, of course, it is a breakthrough in modern history of Ukraine. This is point one. Point two is that in a few recent months, we encountered in Ukraine issues and problems Ukraine has never had in its modern history. And in modern, starting from 1991 at least, one of the most recent ones is issue of occupied territories and internally displaced persons. How to construct the relationships with those who remain on the occupied territories but want to stay Ukrainian nationals, but don't want to leave Crimea because it's their homeland, because they don't want to give it up to the occupiers. But on the other hand, of course, they are extremely vulnerable. They are basically now targets in a situation of lawlessness, which is in Crimea, where all actions are arbitrary, depending only upon the will of commanders of paramilitary squads and Russian occupying forces. Internally displaced persons is also something I'm unseen before, and short-term efforts, assistance efforts, are undertaken by, again, mostly civil society organizations, but there is an understanding that we need to hope for better. Of course, we need to hope that there will be soon a situation when these people will be able to go back, but we need to build our strategies coming from the negative perspective. So we need long-term strategies, sustainable ones, how internally displaced persons might integrate in their new environment, how they might continue their life despite horrible things which happened to them. And three, of course, we continue feeling this massive effect of to say it bluntly, of Russian propaganda machine. I'm a former international news journalist myself, and I met in several difficult places my Russian colleagues, like in Abkhazia during Georgian-Russian war in 2008. I've at that time already seen how they work and what their purpose of work is. It's huge. I mean, as a machine, it's huge. We encounter the traces of Russian propaganda in international media, in foreign language media, a lot. But somehow we should be able to cope with that. I'm not sure we can. At the moment, it looks like we are, if I can say anything, like we are losing informational war. So, on point one, on point two, and on point three, of course, we need broad cooperation internationally with anyone who might understand how important the situation in Ukraine now is, not only for Ukraine, but for the whole system of international security. Basically, in our view, what happened changed the whole system of international security. It's again might makes right principle being in the first place. It's again nostalgia for nuclear weapons in Ukraine, which was caused by events, recent events, and many other things which changed the whole international security landscape. And also we need best practices internationally, how people cope with similar situations. Of course, there is nothing that can be just transferred. But we need best practices and analysis on how to implement best of the best in Ukraine with assistance of those who would be willing and able to help. Thank you.
Sasha, Vovod, do you have any thoughts being here in Washington about things that you think need to be done by people here in the United States to help?
We call all independent democratic states and United States of America to raise the issue of situation in Ukraine as a matter of urgency, because violence, escalation, forced disappearance, tortures, killings, enter minorities under threats, all this call for immediate reaction from international community. That's why, first point, we make sure that Ukraine government is effectively supporting and undertaking independent and transparent investigation into human rights violations with security throughout the country since November last year, because it's not a matter of revenge, it's a matter of justice, it's a matter of prejudice, it's a matter of prevention of human rights violation. Second, a request from the Ukrainian government to provide a plan on the reforms in regard to the respect of the rule of law, the independence of judiciary, the control of law enforcement agencies, and the fights of corruptions. We, as a civil rights organization and civil society, we understand that we have a window of possibilities, and we try to influence and to push our government to provide such reforms, and we need help in this issue. We ask to continue to regularly visit Ukraine, its regions, and support, empower, and protect human rights defenders in Ukraine, especially keep as attention and civil society in Crimea, eastern and south regions, because if these people didn't feel the help, they can't struggle for human rights and for democracy. Also, we need to provide, it's needed to provide the assistance in assuring basic security. Any assistance to Ukrainian army, military, logistical supplies would be a clear signal to Russia that United States of America is not giving up on Ukraine. And special assistance for law enforcement body to protect electoral process in the dangerous eastern and south regions is also very important. It's very, very important financial support of reforms of Ukraine, but with respect to looming default, some financial assistance may be needed even before the IMF package. And also, we appeal to journalists, never use Russia official media as a source of fact verification, especially on developments on the ground in Ukraine. Be aware that just as in the Soviet times, this is an integral part of the military campaign waged by the Kremlin. Maybe Volva would like to add something.
No, just agree, and probably it's better to answer questions to be more fruitful.
Well, let me take advantage of the fact that I'm up here to ask the first question. Right now, there's a great deal of talk in Ukraine about the need for decentralization. Even today, I believe there was an interview with the head of the Central Election Committee who said that possibly something could be done at the same time as the second round of elections. What are your thoughts, what are civil society's thoughts about the pluses and minuses of decentralization, and what needs to be done to make this happen effectively and not become a disaster?
It seems that nobody in Ukraine against decentralization. It's more an issue and discussion should be Ukraine be decentralized to become a federation, and as according to the sociological survey, the majority of Ukrainians want Ukraine continue to be as a unitarian state, but with more power on a local level. Today, during the whole Ukrainian independent history, it was an awful situation when the local government doesn't really can do nothing on the local level because they pay taxes to Kiev, and after that receive some subventions and do little things. And it also create a situation when local governments could blame Kiev that we can do nothing, it's all the fault of central government. We are good people, we are expressing your view, and we want a better life for all of us, but we can do nothing because all of this is Ukrainian government. So now the central government want to change the situation, and it's also a wish or an idea which expressed by pro-Russian supporters, and there is no disagreement, but some of not some, but many of pro-Russian supporters from Moscow, they use the word and the conception of federalization of Ukraine, and it would be the first step for collapse of our state and destabilization in the whole Eastern Europe, because As we can see with example of Crimea, we have only one autonomous republic, and actually what Russia do, they cut this piece first, and probably they use this idea of federalization in future, and what, and it's not clear what they want, but we definitely don't want this federalization, because it will be the first step to to put at least our part of the country in a civil war, and we may become a gray zone like South Ossetia or Transnistria, and unfortunately our central government do not explain people and local elites what really happened if this idea of federalization will become a reality. It would be a disaster.
Thank you. The floor is open for questions. Young lady.
Wait for the microphone, please, and maybe you could identify yourself.
I'm Linda Kinsler with the New Republic. I was just wondering if you could speak to what you think the presidential candidates could do for civil society, or if there are any particular presidential candidates that you are most hopeful about. Like, do you think Poroshenko has promise? And what do you think of the field in general?
You see the great difference between Orange Revolution and Euromaidan, that Euromaidan wasn't led by politics. It was the desire of people. And that's why they have no political leader or leaders. Answering on your question, I must admit that Euromaidan SOS, Amnesty International of Ukraine, and another human rights organizations sent for all candidates for president elections a questionnaire which devoted the issue of human rights. And when we receive the answers, we will see what the place of human rights and democracy are in their program. Is this important for us because it's our work?
Okay, I would like to add that Poroshenko is not ideal candidate, and but in the situation in which we right now, it would be great just to elect this person in the first round. And what our country needs is stability. And if we will be able to elect a pro-Western, reliable president, which seems Poroshenko can be as a president, it would be a possibility to stabilize the situation, and after that move to other reforms.
Well, on quite a subjective note as well, but also reflecting, I think, quite a popular idea now, maybe bridging also the first question and the second. It is really popular to think how less authoritarian the ruling structures can be in Ukraine. So when it comes to a shift of power to regional, local level, or even to grassroots level in some ways, in the same way to avoid the situation when one person, one small group of people can usurp the power in the whole country as it happened just in front of our eyes. So those who would like to see that happening, I mean transfer of powers maybe to the parliament, or maybe just at least installing different system of checks and balances. Of course, that logically leads us, or them, or us, to thinking that ideal candidate would be a candidate on a good societal mission, in a way. The president who will wholeheartedly do everything possible to limit presidential powers in Ukraine. And this is quite a difficult task. In my personal opinion, presidential elections are less important now than what civil society does, and then parliamentary elections, which will hopefully come next, because the parliament is still the same, we have now, as we've had 2 months ago, and same parliament which voted for all these incredibly, I have many adjectives here, laws which we witnessed in all this month, especially in January, the same parliament now adopts new laws with totally different color. It just basically means that these people do not represent will of population or anything. They represent the survival instinct, which is maybe good for them, but not for the country.
Hi, my name is Megan Buskey. I used to be on staff at the Open Society Institute working on the Russia and Ukraine programs. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about sort of political mentality right now in the East. What would a Poroshenko presidency look like for Eastern Ukrainians? Would it be something that they would accept or would be, you know, happy about? Are Eastern Ukrainians in general participating or planning on participating in the presidential elections? And finally, I was also wondering about what the Party of Regions, the future of the Party of Regions in Ukraine, was the party discredited by the violence that was perpetrated under Yanukovych? Thank you.
Probably, yeah, as a citizens of Eastern Ukraine. Sorry, it was a lot of questions. Would be Eastern Ukrainians happy with Poroshenko? I don't know that they would be happy with any other president, but he looks like a compromise figure, and they would be more willing to vote for him and he will able to collect more votes as pro-Western candidate and kind of compromise figure than anybody else. I would say other question was if local people want to participate in election. As I told, it's not, but the majority of people, they really want a stable country. They if it wouldn't be more provocation and destabilization from Russian side, it definitely the majority of people will come and vote. They may vote for different candidates, for pro-Russian, pro-Western, but they definitely want stability and they accept elections. What else?
The Party of Regions, has it been discredited, if it was discredited by the violence?
Yes. I would say it's not by the violence, but by the previous policy. The people our two regions and Crimea were totally controlled by Party of Regions, and they use this idea of Russian language and kind of pro-Russian vector of policy. But now people, even their previous supporters, they don't believe in them anymore. They, during these gatherings, pro-Russian gatherings, meetings, they just blame them, they don't want to hear them, they tell goodbyes. Some of them were beaten, not like severely, but just they don't want to listen to them. And somehow it's kind of, it's not a bad situation, but like a few months ago, this party, they hold the whole country, 45 million in their hand. And a few months, they lost everything. And what they face, what they should expect in the future, it's really a big question. And this is people who have money, who had power, and probably it's those who can be blamed in destabilization in the part of the country as some kind of supporters of this pro-Russian actions in our part of country.
I would like to add that separatists announced that they will persecute people who were voting in to take part in presidential election. So your question is better transform how many people can risk with their health and even with their lives and to take part in the electoral process.
Doug Wake, no current affiliation, but former U.S. government and OSCE official. If I may, two questions. One has already been touched upon with the last answer about elections, but I'm wondering, in the regions where administrative buildings have been taken and there is a presence of these armed forces, how likely is it that the Ukrainian government and its election commission will have the pure administrative capacity to organize the election effectively throughout the territory of the Oblast in eastern Ukraine? And if I may, a completely separate question. I wonder if any of you would have any comment, despite all of your intense, extremely busy efforts over the past months within Ukraine, on your ability to work with counterparts and colleagues in civil society in the Russian Federation, which, of course, is itself under considerable pressure, but in many cases has been quite focused on showing solidarity with Ukrainian civil society.
So the ability of our government to proceed election or to
conduct the election.
Conduct the election. So, like in my, I live in a city or town about 500,000, and actually the destabilized situation, it's only one block in the center of the city. The rest of city lives its ordinary life. People go, smile, you know, like they really worry about situation, but it's totally, if it wouldn't be a direct kind of action from Russia side and directed by them military forces, the election will be conducted. The situation is a little bit different in some cities and some towns in Donetsk region. For example, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, it's towns about 100,000 people. So they are kind of occupied and controlled by this pro-Russian forces and local people, and probably the central government will not be able to control those territories, but it's only a few towns, and so if the situation at least will become will be like today, there is no threat election to happen.
I try to answer to the second question. We as Euromaidan SOS closely work with Russian human rights organizations because now we work in Crimea and Eastern region, and in Crimea it's no necessity in lawyers because there is no legal space for Ukrainian lawyers to work with and to help people. And I can give an example briefly. When one Andriy Shikun, the leader of Crimea Euromaidan, called to his colleague that he is captured and he is in detention of police in the railway station. And after 10 minutes, our mobile group went to this railway station, went to this place of detention and asked police, where is this person? But the police said there is no such person in detention, and it took place before referendum. If it can be now, I think that they will capture our activists also to these detentions, because when released, when Andriy Shikun was released, I spoke with him in hospital, and he described how severely he was tortured and what he was asked, and what he can suffer it, he and his colleague who were in this situation, and he exactly was in this detention place. So lawyers can't help in such situation, but we ask our Russian human rights organizations, colleagues from this organization, to help with monitor situation, because now there is no mobile group, our mobile group in Crimea, because of danger, because we're not prepared to work in such conditions. And for example, we teach the experience of mobile groups in Chechnya, how they work in Chechnya, and human rights Russians organization provides a training for us, and we will work together in peninsula.
In the back row, please.
Oh, may I add something,
please?
Talking about what can be done by international community to help us election to be conducted. So there are several places around the world when the election polls were under the threat. For example, recent examples from Afghanistan, but election actually happened. So we need this kind of experience to be some kind of shared with our internal forces and with our government to help it to actually to protect people who are willing to vote and to protect this right of majority of Ukrainian population. And this is one of the things which can be done to protect the future of our country.
Kirsten Scher from the Stimson Center. I spend a good deal of time in the Jewish community in the United States. It's incredibly difficult to explain to the Jewish community why Ukraine is important. And it's difficult because, as everyone knows, Ukraine does have an extremely unfortunate history of anti-Semitism. I am totally convinced, I've been following the events very closely, and I'm totally convinced that 99% of the recent events were provocations arranged by the Russians. They have all of the hallmarks. When I go through St. Sophia Square in Kiev, there's a statue. And it's a statue of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Bogdan Khmelnytsky is known for a couple of things. First of all, the Treaty of Pereyaslav, which united Ukraine with the Russian Empire, and secondly, for being the greatest mass murderer of Jews before Adolf Hitler. Has there been any discussion, or is it just premature or silly, to think about removing that statue? That's my question.
Okay, probably that's to me, Kat. The short answer is no. There's been no discussion specifically about removing the statue. And I don't really think that such a discussion will come about in next quite long time. What really has been started at some point of time, quite recently, first in quite narrow circles of historians, and then it started to expand, involving more and more civic activists and just people who cared, was discussion about historical memory and relationships between different ethnic and religious communities in Ukraine throughout its history. Because, of course, for Ukrainian community with its historical memory, let's not go into how it came about this way, etc. Bogdan Khmelnytsky is the leader of National Liberation War, which resulted in quite an unfortunate agreement with Russia in the first place. For Jewish community of Ukraine, Bogdan Khmelnytsky led a massive movement which resulted in this, as you described, an incredible number of deaths of Ukrainian Jews. But unfortunately, Ukrainian history as a history of borderlands or as applied to mid-20th century Timothy Snyder famously described bloodlines, had so many points like this between different ethnic communities which still live in Ukraine. One of the most recent ones when it comes to mid-20th century is Volyn and conflict between ethnic Poles and ethnic Ukrainians in those lands, which was also a tragedy of incredible scale, even when it comes to Second World War circumstances. And there are many more relationships between Crimean Tatars and Ukrainians, which are now on the same side, have never been easy until some point of time. So discussion about taking history, have different takes on history and trying to represent it in the whole variety of Ukraine, ethnic, religious, etc. These discussions started to take place some time ago, of course, just to keep in mind, not to say outwards, you know, for you he is a hero or she is a hero, and for us he or she is a murderer. So you should shut up and take our point of view, because our point of view is more important. But of course, to include, at least to an extent possible at the first stage, views and memories of different groups which reside in Ukraine. And this is also quite, provides quite, I don't even know how to describe it properly, dangerous turn when it comes to the current events. You know, the whole discussion of complexity of the Second World War events in Central and Western Ukraine, at least leaving alone the whole territory, now is for many people replaced with propaganda slogans. Those who, instead of understanding what was National Liberation Movement in its I just don't want to say positive and negative, because every group has its own positives and negatives here. But in its different aspects during Second World War in Western Ukraine, instead of understanding this complexity, now we have again cliches, you are Banderovets and I am against Banderovets. Banderovets means fascists. Everyone who is pro-Ukrainian is fascist. And you have again this Soviet-like approach to history, black and white, us and them. And this is a dangerous setback when it comes to processes which have evolved in historical community in recent years in Ukraine. So about state, you probably know. About understanding the complexity, yes, it has been started, but purely political events which we witness now, and I'm afraid not from the Maidan side, can be a huge setback to this healthy discussion which has been started.
I just briefly added that during Euromaidan events, we lost more 100 people, and this called Sky Hunt.
Heavenly Hundred.
Небесная сотня, как?
The Heavenly Hundred.
And one of this Heavenly Hundred was from Jewish Self-Defense Union.
Up front here, please.
Hi, I'm George Zadisky with USAID. I have two questions. The U.S. government, obviously, and USAID are trying to cobble together some kind of package of assistance, given that what's going on now, even though it's being done under the threat of imminent, or maybe not so imminent, you know, confrontation. But if you had like a blue sky, idealistic, or carte blanche, like where would you emphasize, where should United States assistance be focused? On civil society, on, you know, media to counter this mass disinformation that's going on by the juggernaut of the Russian propaganda? That's my first question. Where should we put our money? And second question is probably plagued a lot of people. I mean, I lived in Kyiv from 1999 to 2004. For 22 years, there seemed to be kind of a tolerance, a strained tolerance, a little dance going on between Russia and Ukraine. Ukraine never wanted to be a part of NATO. They made that clear. They understood where, you guys understand where you are in the scheme of things, who you're bordering. Kuchma and all the other presidents tacked a little bit to the east, and then they tacked a little bit to the west, and they played that game very cleverly. And then in 2004, there was the Orange Revolution, and you had a so-called, it turned out badly, but you had a democratically elected president, who was more pro-Western, had a Western wife, American, Ukrainian-American wife. So what was it that triggered Putin now, in this particular instance, to become bellicose, to grab territory, and to threaten a wider conflict? I mean, for 22 years, there's been some kind of détente, if you will, or uneasiness. But I, what's your best guess at this? I mean, I'm not so clear about the optics here. Why now?
I just start and ask my colleague to aid it. As I understand, your first question is on what kind of support have concentrated United States of America. I just remind that United States of America was one of the signer of Budapest Memorandum, who guaranteed Ukrainian territorial integrity and sovereignty. So, and I announced that we ask United States of America some kind of support briefly. It's oversight that independent and transparent investigation into human rights violations during Euromaidan. It's a request from Ukraine government to provide a plan on the needed reforms which we needed to be done in law enforcement bodies, in independence of judiciary, etc. And needed assistance in ensuring basic security, modernization of our army, to help assistance teach law enforcement body how to provide election in such difficult circumstances, like in eastern regions, etc. And your second question was, as I understand, about that we have not the first Maidan in our country, as I understand.
Yeah, well, basically, quickly, is this because Yushchenko was actually, Yanukovych was actually overthrown and fled the country, and this was going to set a terrible example for people in Russia and in near abroad that you could actually run somebody out of power that's supported by Putin? Because my question is, why now, like after 22 years of independence and even some more pro-Western leaning presidents, what was the tipping point this time? Was it the ouster of Yanukovych that he fled the country, and this was a terrible example for possible dissidents and or anti-Putin forces, and he had to smash this down?
So I will answer as I understand your question. If I not understand correct, my colleagues aided. But I'm look so young woman, but I took part in first Maidans in my country. I was a member when I was a student of Orange Revolution. I remember Text Maidan, Language Maidan, and now Euro Maidan. And nobody of us are not guaranteed that Ukraine not need another Maidan. But we strongly believe that this situation, which we have now, it's cost for us a very big cost because of deaths of people, of relatives, of colleagues, and we take responsibility not for politicians, not for parties, but by others, by ourselves. We created, as Maxim mentioned, a lot of initiatives. How civil society can oversight the reforms in different sphere. For example, we created reanimation package of reform and press our parliament to adopt it a necessity law. And so we not rely upon government only, but by our own force.
Maybe I can just add to the second question. Well, there are two parts. for me here. First is guesses, which I think are well-based factually, but they are still guesses. And another one is rather effect. Effect is tactical. It was the most brilliantly chosen moment of weakness. There was never such a moment in Ukrainian history when, literally in days, when there was no proper, like the whole power infrastructure collapsed in front of our eyes. The regime was overthrown. It dedicated and its predecessors many years into constructing the system when everything in the regions was ruled from Kiev in, you know, manual regime. So when suddenly in Kiev regime collapsed, the regions became disoriented. Of course, it would be fixed and restored in a very short period of time, but that moment was the best for any proper aggressive intervention. So that was the best moment to pick. When it comes to reasons why to do that at all, well, I mean, on one hand, yes, it was really a bad example. Orange Revolution did not overthrow anyone. It prevented Yanukovych from taking power. Kuchma left peacefully with guarantees, and the whole thing looked very legitimate, etc. Yanukovych was overthrown. It was a revolution in this sense. Of course, this example was, and still is, very dangerous for some and inspiring for others. The more we will know about reasons for Yanukovych's actions, the more probably we'll understand how closely he was tied to Kremlin and to Putin and to his aides. So it was not only overthrow of authoritarian ruler, but it was overthrow of pro-Moscow authoritarian ruler. On the other hand, of course, as you might imagine, we receive a lot of media inquiries from Western media about the far right at Maidan. My organization deals with discrimination and monitoring of the far right groups for years, so we received the whole lot of whatever happened in Ukraine, the regime has fallen. We received inquiries about the far right at Maidan. Russian military intervention started. We received inquiries about the far right at Maidan. Then Crimea was occupied, then annexed. We received inquiries about the far right at Maidan. Then we had first internally displaced persons, then troubles in the East. We continue to receive these inquiries. But the issue is that in Ukraine we might identify this or that rather marginal political leader as the biggest nationalist, ethnic nationalist in Ukraine. In Russia, the biggest ethnic nationalist is Vladimir Putin. It's his ideas, it's his background. He declared it several times. His favorite philosopher is Ilyin, and his views concerning Ukraine were never views concerning an equal partner state and nation. So I think why to do that goes deeply into his vision of the world and role of Russia, but the moment was just chosen ideally. And just very briefly on the first question, where to invest money, I think that Alexandra is absolutely right. Of course, I would be a bad representative of civil society, not saying that you should invest in civil society, but it has also a good reason. We've seen during this month how important it is. This is who's done the whole, I don't mean NGOs only, I mean civil society, even in rather Gramscian terms, you know, this network of citizens who's done the most essential things. On the other hand, of course, we see that all programs which were implemented, many of them were stalled for this period of time, and people invested everything they had, both emotionally, physically, and financially. So civil society will need support. And of course, reforms are needed, but investment in reforms, but it should be rather accountable and transparent procedure when it comes to the government, with in cooperation with international actors and Ukrainian non-government actors.
I just briefly added that if we're talking about assistance, we need conducting a big project and big direction of activity to make a dialogue between majority of population of eastern regions, because these groups are only the majority of projects educational projects are focused only on youth or socially active people in eastern region, but only Russia works with majority, and we need to work with them in very simple form, very simple ways, but it's work what needed to be done.
I guess have one more engagement scene, so I think one more, if we could keep it brief. Please, or maybe, is there two hands have been up there, to just ask your questions back to back, and please try.
My name is Kurt Hageman. I work for the Center for International Private Enterprise, but I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Eastern Ukraine from 2010 to 2012, as Boba knows. And I guess my question is, having lived in the East for 2 years, I never really got a sense of a desire for separatism or a desire to join Russia. I always got the sense that the East, you know, they were happy being Ukrainian, but also like these connections that they had with their family and friends in Russia. So I guess my question is, what exactly is the Eastern public opinion towards the takings of these governmental buildings and the Ukrainian security buildings? And to what extent are these efforts indigenous? I know that there's pretty much a global consensus that Russia is responsible, but what's the Ukrainian involvement as well?
Hi, Matthew Kopp for Carnegie Endowment. My question is also for Mr. Shcherbachenko. There are a lot of heavy industry. There's a lot of heavy industry in the East and a lot of ties with Russia. To what degree do you think this will influence the ultimate ending of this situation in the East? To what degree could the severing of these ties influence the East? Obviously, it would be a lot of revenue at the loss, but at the same time, Russia is also dependent on Eastern Ukraine. And also, if you could just clarify your statistics on the different divisions of opinion in East Ukraine. When you talked about 10% to 15% that was pro-Russian, did you mean that actually supports the separatists or that just has a very pro-Russian orientation?
Okay. Yes, thank you for your questions. So about Kurt asked, what is the public opinion about taking over this building by separatists? So the majority of people see this as a destruction of their not happy but normal life. And they don't kind of understand that they don't really want this to happen. It's there are no such examples in a life of a people who live there, and they don't remember such examples, I know, probably from the Second World War. So they do not support this, but their philosophy of their lives is kind of paternalistic approach. They expect that somebody come and solve this problem, and what they ready to do in majority of cases is just to come to election pool, and but they not ready to protect the state buildings from the pro-Russian forces or aggressive part of this population, because majority people just they didn't get anything from the state. It's still from them for many years, and they do not see reason to protect the state buildings from Russia, which many of them still see as a want to see as a friendly country. About the question on which my my opinion on divisions. So it's mainly based on statistics, sociological surveys. Many of them were conducted recently, and they show that the absolute majority of population of eastern Ukraine doesn't want to join Russia. They want to be part of Ukrainian state, different state with respect to the cultural and political differences. But about those pro-Russian protesters, many of those people who are actively involved in protests, it's people with a very simple education, I would say, with a very simple income, and they usually don't able to express the vision of future and of current political situation. They don't actually able to explain what in their vision is federalization of Ukraine, or it doesn't necessarily mean that all these 10 or 15% want to join Russia. Probably they want, like, many of them want more power to the local level and kind of protection of the Russian language
I'm afraid I might have to cut it short, but I hope you will join me in thanking our guest for a very interesting discussion.